There's something very specific about this. There's no melanin in it.
What does that mean?
That means it's an albino. There's a specific kind of dog, and we may be able. This is our first real lead. Blah blah blah.
Why is it only white people don't know what a lack of melanin is?
Nearly always care when it comes to killing people.
Yeah.
Nearly always.
Right.
There is this sort of story going on, especially with the way that they cut between these two characters of purity versus perversion. Like, we see a little bit of her kind of just, yes, she's by herself in her apartment, but we get a little bit of sexy versus the naked bodies that D'Onofrio has in his place. And then there's like the, especially when they start crossing over into eventually when we get to the therapy sessions, there's this sort of cross-pollination, and I don't want to get too far into it, but she eventually kind of merges into that perversion too.
Yeah, it's so funny that over the years when I've watched this movie, I've definitely been like, oh, J-Lo's smoking a joint, right? And then I'm like, whatever, guy is about to mutilate and then diddle-ish a body. And when I'm like, oh... And when I'm like, ew, right? But it should be like I should be like, oh, whatever. It's an adult relaxing, as opposed to like, it's an adult viewing this perverse, scary thing.
Right.
I don't know.
It's this very like, you know, to me, I see it as like two different extremes on the, you know, like, you know, how a lot of people think that booze is something that's bad for you and drugs are something that's bad for you. And it's like those things in moderation aren't. In mm-hmm. the excess, they can be.
Mm-hmm.
But those are like, again, if I eat a donut and I'm a nice person versus a carrot and I'm a which do you want to deal with?
For sure, I would rather have a tubby, kind-hearted person stuck in an elevator with me than in like an angry, scrawny, bone mm-hmm. person.
Right. I mean, not unless that elevator is in peril and the heavier person is going
No, that's just extra cushion. We're not going to deny all of the good things that being cute and chubbers is all about. I love it. There's nothing wrong with that.
My head is full of nothing but like this reference. This thing reminds me of this, and that just reminded me of the end of Gravity Falls when Seuss like grabs Dipper and Mabel and says, "I will be your cushion." I'm just like, yes, that's all I want is just to be someone's cushion. Like, I'm
Seuss is the best.
Seuss is great. Anyways,
Milky Beth. Oh, we cut back to her watching a cartoon, which is
Forbidden Planet,
which is a 19 something film about
Fantastic Planet from 1978.
Oh, yes,
it's Fantastic Planet.
Yeah.
I corrected you earlier, and then I just corrected you back.
No, Jen just corrected me.
Okay. So. I knew that it was Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Well, I'm going to mess that up, but we only have to reference it the once.
Fantastic Forbidden Planet.
So the Drags are an alien species that has something to do with the human-y ones. The Drags are like a big blue guy, and then they've got these illiterate little dumb guys running around that are the human types, and they keep them as pets. And they let them do all the things that pets do. Like, they do stupid things too, like they tie their hair together so that they can fight. That's one scene that we see J-Lo watching. The audio and the visuals don't match up to the actual film in this part, but like it's fascinating because it's a movie that a lot of stoners watch.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really out there. It's very visually and like this film, it's very surreal.
Right, but it's also heavy in metaphor, and like one of my first things when I watched this movie was like, I wish I could put this movie through the lens of like metaphors, but I don't feel like it's giving me a lot to work with.
I certainly never caught on to any number of the references that this movie makes. I just was not exposed to the things that it does.
Right.
But like now, having been illuminated to that, there are so many different things that this movie alludes to in terms of like, I mean, what does surrealism do for us? Surrealism is like this could be physically true, but I'll tilt your head in such a way that like you see it in a perspective that you've never noticed before. And we do a lot of tilting and swirling and turning and figuring stuff out in this film. And we're going to do a terrible job of describing it to our audience. But this is the start of it. This is like the clue. This is the, hey, remember that Forbidden Planet movie where like everything was turned on its head?
Fantastic Planet. Forbidden Planet is a movie from the 50s. It's a sci-fi. It's got this big old robot in it. I think MST3K.
Danger.
That's
Doc Robinson.
That's Lost in Space.
Yeah.
No, but Forbidden Planet was like it was like this big metaphor for what was that Shakespearean play, The Tempest. I think that's what it was like. It was like a remake of The Tempest, but in space. In space.
They go to investigate a colony that's being quiet, and they have some secret or something like that. I didn't find a lot of details.
Fantastic Planet.
Right. So kind of going back to the movie, the important thing that we should note here is Carl suspends himself above this bleached corpse, and he watches the movie of her dying because he's recording it, and he positions his hand into his crotch area.
Yeah, general dong region, I would call it. Yeah. Scientifically, I would call it that.
And then there's a lot of shaking, and then there's an O face.
He goes, and he like a spittle flies from his mouth, and I'm like, I hate that.
I can totally see why his wife didn't want to be near in the same bed with him for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Vincent D'Onofrio's wife.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, so we go from Fantastic Planet. Uh-huh. Thank you. I get there. She's gazing down as she falls asleep. And then as her visions lift up, have you noticed like no less than like 6 times we gaze upon like a brown field that's either like sand or like, well, it's sand the first 2 times and then it's like a horse. And then it's like, this director really likes like the dream begins as my vision falls across a field of brown.
Well, I think it brown in this movie, but the transitions are trying. I like the transitions in this between scenes because it makes it feel like more like cohesive than I think it would have felt. Like if you take the transitions out of it, it would have just felt very static. And this helps with the flow and with the pacing in a lot of ways.
Well, the director obviously understands dream logic really well and uses that to our advantage.
Right.
But also, at some point, they refer to dreams as being this. Okay, she is entering a dream state, and a lot of this film takes place in the subconscious, right? Can I just soapbox for you for just a second? Yeah, let's climb up on there. Let's put 2 soapboxes on top of each other. Your dreams are not your subconscious. And it makes me mad that when people assume one to the other, your dream is your dreams and not like your aspirations in life, but your dreams are generally your brain taking stimuli that has happened over to you over the course of some period of time and then applies like as much logic as it possibly could at a minimum rate so that you can process like the chemicals that have entered your brain during a day. And what is important when you dream, admittedly, is your emotions behind those dreams. If you have a dream where your teeth fall out and you're naked in front of your pastor, hey, hi, how are you? I've never totally had those dreams. Yeah. They're anxiety dreams. You've released a lot of cortisol and other hormones that mean, hey, you're stressed. You've got anxiety. Hey, hi, how are you? You need to process these emotions. But also, hey, my teeth aren't all going to fall out. And there's not going to be a moment when I find myself naked in front of my pastor. And those are just the ways my brain interpreted those strong emotions. My subconscious, however, on the other hand, on the other side, let's flip it over. Let's look at the different part of my brain. My subconscious takes things that are difficult for me to understand, comprehend. And then I act those things out underneath my overt emotion, desires, and actions. So I say I'm having trouble with a coworker, right? Well, on the surface, I'm like, hey, Karen, how are you? Good job today. You're great, right? And then we go about our day. But then my subconscious is like, I'm really nice to Karen. I don't talk shit about her at all. And then I spend the next 2 hours bitching about her to somebody else. And while I've never been nothing but nice to Karen, and I don't consider myself a gossip or a dirty double talker, my subconscious denies everything on the surface and totally betrays the fact that I am kind of catty and I am kind of mouthy and I might be a little gossipy. And I want to be a better person than that, but my subconscious, in a self-preservation sort of way, just comes out that way. I'm hoping to be better. I would love to be better. But my dreams and my subconscious are wholly different. And when they make them the same thing, and it's going to scream.
Yeah. And that's
I just climb off my soapbox.
And that's important because as the camera is looking down on the blanket that J-Lo has covering up her legs, you see the ripples where her legs are. And then that transitions into this like desert scene that we saw at the very beginning.
Yeah, we're back at the dry lake bed.
Right. And that's when she's asking for Edward, like, Edward, are you there? Edward, are you there? And she goes over to the log that he was leaning up against.
Hey, guess what? Guess what?
Yeah.
Were there seagulls? Or seals, she would say.
Yeah.
Were there seals at the beach when you went yachting? Because he got found on a beach or whatever later. But like,
right.
Hey, guess what? Animal number five.
Yeah.
It's a seagull.
Yeah. So she asks him, were there seals getting murdered on the beach when you had your accident?
That's terrible.
Yeah. And so she like looks into this hole in the log, and that's when we get Seal Boy.
Yeah, I called him Shark Boy, but he's got these weird like turtle flippers. And his weird, cringy, like, Insta filter face where it's like...
Yeah. And, like, the jump scare in the very first scene, it kind of makes him look like he's got fangs and his face is a little disfigured. Like, he's one of those Joss Whedon vampires.
Yes. Yes. Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. So it was one of those things where he's, like, is a little bit more seal-like. And as she's smoking the joint, we do see, like, some clips. Yes, like, Billionaire's Son.
Newspaper clippings.
Right. And it was, like, Billionaire's Son is in a coma and seals are mysteriously going.
She pins that up in her house.
Yeah.
Could you imagine?
And so at this point, we kind of completely cut away from Vincent D'Onofrio and Jennifer Lopez. And instead, we're focused on, that's what it is. After the scene, that's when we see Vincent D'Onofrio masturbating over the corpse, and as he's completing himself,
the train goes by, and then it's going over an overpass, and then you see people squeal up, and there's like, hey, there's the tire tracks we know, and hey, there's like, he must have hit the barrier because there's green turquoisey paint there now, and then three men who've joined themselves, one of them being Vince Vaughn, the other two being guys I don't remember. They go and they, in this really kind of like Three Stooges way to me, like they go to the edge and they look down and they're like, well, there's that dead body. Somebody standing by the plastic wrap body looks up and is like, huh? It's so dumb. Yeah. Hey, Jen, you got some Sean facts for us?
Well, I've got part of a Sean fact, and maybe as a way of introducing the full fact, I will bring in like the first sentence of it, because it's sort of a thematic choice by the director at this point.
Yes.
There are several references to the TV series Twin Peaks in this movie. The body of the victim in the beginning here is found wrapped in plastic on a riverbed, like Laura Palmer in the Twin Peaks pilot.
Yep.
Yep. We've got some other Twin Peaks references, and I'll try to point those out when they come up.
I would like it.
So these are police officers who are checking out a dead body, and one of them is a guy who, like, you can see, like, the camera cuts to the face underneath.
There's flies and all over this lady's face, and you're like, oh, that's terrible.
And then the guy rips the plastic off, and he's like, whoa.
Yeah, he stands face over the body. He's a murder investigator. He stands face over the body. He takes a deep breath, and I'm like, I don't do that when I take the garbage out. I don't do that on the rare occasion I do the litter box. It does not take very long into adulthood for a person to not breathe in. Like, if you're emptying the laundry basket, you're not going to find any gems there, my guy.
But it makes me wonder, based on the bleach bath that she's had, if the bleach was causing the person to take a big whiff. Like, what is that smell?
The presence of flies denotes rotting flesh to me. And rotting flesh always smells like death. It doesn't matter if it's the chicken carcass you put in the trash bin like 3 days ago, or if it's a body you've come across several days after it's died, even if it's been bleached. Meat is meat, and it's going to be gross. Personal opinion.
Yeah.
You can find me.
I know in some circumstances the smell of bleach, although maybe not as strong, is still present. And it's something that I have to like know if that's bleach or not. I don't know why. But like if I'm walking into a bathroom or something like that, and I will smell deeper if it's been like recently cleaned.
Is it clean in here?
Yeah.
Is it? Nope. That smells like bleach and rotten pig flesh.
Somebody may have laid like the largest turd right after they cleaned it, but I'm still going to be like, oh, is this like freshly cleaned?
You're welcome.
Freshly cleaned turd. And so we see two of the detectives pretty much talking, and then we get this third detective, and that's Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, it goes from them being like, a collar? Yeah, he makes them for them. And okay, so not to completely eliminate the illusion that I'm not a switch and I'm actually a sub, collars are so cute. I love them so much. I would wear one every day. I would just a little like, oh, when I saw like Joker on Harley Quinn's thing in Suicide Squad, I was like, do want, please can, have, please. I've bought a number of chokers over the years. And a custom-made choker, a custom-made collar, I'm like, that's kind of nice.
Yeah. So at this point, I think it cuts between the police procedural part and Carl choosing his next victim.
Yeah. Vince, basically, you can chuck this all out the window. Vince asks a bunch of stupid questions that are 100% procedure. And then is like, I don't want anybody slacking. He's like, hey, I want the coroner's report right away. Nah, brah. We were going to take this serial killer's coroner's report. We're gonna put it on the back burner for a couple weeks. No, they were gonna give it to you right away. Special agent, FBI guy, Vince Vaughn. He's like, I don't want anybody slacking. Who was slacking except for the guy who thought that sticking your face over a dead body and inhaling really deep was a good idea? Who hasn't? And so, yeah. Hey.
Yeah, it's moments like these that we kind of are like, you don't. The writing could have been better.
Well. And as much as I laud this film for having some of the most fantastic visuals I've ever seen, we do cut to Carl stroking a doll's head with sharpied out eyes. Like,
yeah, as he's looking at this lady who's having lunch with a significant other.
What's her fiance?
It turns out to be her fiance. Yeah.
Yeah, and his brain is like.
Yeah. And then it goes like he goes into crazy mode and then he has to get aspirin.
Yeah. I don't know if aspirin is going to solve your schizophrenia, Carl, but I have a feeling it's not.
Right. But again, American healthcare system. Sorry.
I almost spit. That was beautiful. American healthcare system wins the day again.
We do also find out later that this particular fake version of schizophrenia is caused by a virus in the brain. So it is possible that he may continue to be taking aspirin because of headache or fever, so that it really isn't going to help him with his crazy thoughts.
No. But what he registers is my head hurts. He has already justified the voice. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. He just wants the pain to stop. But he has not addressed the fact that, and we can talk about it when we get to the doctor who talks about it, but he's got a literal physical problem with his brain. And we get told, you know, to put some Tylenol on it, you know, but it's not addressing the problem at the source. And that's the American healthcare system for you. Hardcore.
Rub some butter on it.
I'm just like, hey, did you put some Windex on it?
No, you need to pray over it.
Honey, do put hands on it, but also put antibiotic.
Right. And so over these next few scenes, it pretty much just goes through everything that I'm just going to go ahead and break it down for you.
Yeah. So is that guy a scientist or a detective? Tell me.
Which one?
Okay, so they end up at the diner.
Oh, yeah. So I think it's a forensic scientist.
Okay, because I thought he was a doctor. He was there at the crime scene, and then he's like, there's a dog here. I got to look into this. And he stands up and walks away, and I'm like, hold on. Why would you have to look at it? Mm-hmm. You're a detective.
Right. And so it like cuts to the police procedural part, and the guy's looking at the hair and he's like, this is there's something very specific about this. There's no melanin in it.
What does that mean?
That means it's an albino. There's a specific kind of dog, and we may be able, this is our first real lead, blah, blah, blah.
Why is it only white people don't know what a lack of melanin is?
All And so basically the police procedural, you know, goes through this whole...
Wait, they say albino dog.
Right, the albino dog.
Which makes me mad because this dog has a black nose and blue eyes, and albinos would lack any pigmentation, so they'd have a pink nose and pink eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes me mad. We can talk about that later. We can talk about Valentine later. Right.
We're
in the parking garage.
Right. So because it cuts back and forth, I'm just going to kind of like... After the parking garage, I'm just going to go ahead and say everything that D'Onofrio is doing.
Yeah, then
we can talk about, because at this point, they're pretty much on two separate tracks, and we can kind of see where they're going to be meeting up later on. So, parking garage. Lady is going to her car, and she's being super suspicious. She's being careful, and then she gets into her car real quick, and you think it's all safe, but then she backs up, and then suddenly she hits, it feels like she hits something, and she sees a dog whining behind her, and so she automatically gets out. And my note here was, this is why you always back into a parking space.
Are you that guy?
Yeah, I'm that guy.
I'm 100% not that guy.
Yeah.
But I will neurotically check my mirrors going backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And if I happen to hit a dog backing out of a underground concrete parking space, I'll just keep backing up. I'll finish the job. Poor dog.
And so she doesn't. She gets out and she goes and she sees the dog and she's like, oh, are you okay?
He's the best actor in this film.
Mm-hmm.
The dog is laying there like big eyes. And then she's like, oh, poor baby, baby. And then she pets him, and then she looks over and she's like, there's a brick behind my tire. And then she like goes to touch the brick, and that's when D'Onofrio grabs her.
Right. And this is also the moment when I was like, and this is why I choose not to lose weight, because then no guy's going to be able to grab my 300-pound ass.
Okay. 100%. We learn also in this back and forth scene that Vince Vaughn's character has been sleeping at the office. He's been drinking beers at the office. He brought an electric toothbrush to the office. They're like, you need to go. Okay, skip all of this. It really doesn't matter. He's going to go give a lecture, and he's like, hey, we're going to find albino dogs. Throws down some papers. He's like, we're going to look up trucks. He throws down some papers to some other detective guys. They should have gone through all the albino paperwork first and then done the truck thing and not try to do them both simultaneously. But whatever. What drives me crazy about this scene as he exposits about like this guy's motives and his modus operandi, right? Like there's a DARE poster on the wall behind them. And as the daughter of someone who used to give DARE classes, that makes me feel like there are going to be children in this room at some point, and there's a big old wall of dead ladies with their tatas hanging out. And I'm like, who's bringing kids into this room? Well, who shares this space? Who are these people?
I don't know, but I think this is the same scene where and this is the quality of the writing. If we don't stop him, he ain't gonna stop himself.
Yeah. Duh, mother fudgers.
Generally, criminals don't stop themselves.
Okay, so we also... Okay, so... we cut to Vince's character talking to the latest abductee's mom.
Right, and her fiancé.
Is her name Julie or something?
I think so.
And then, like, the fiancé is a Skarsgård?
No, that's a Peter Sarsgaard without the K.
Sarsgaard.
There's a difference between Sarsgaard. The patriarch of the Skarsgård clan.
There are two big family of actors in Hollywood. One of them is the Skarsgård family, and the other is the Sarsgaard family.
Right. So Bill Skarsgård, the guy who played It in It Chapter 1 and Chapter 2.
Surprisingly adorable out of makeup.
Right. He said on the Stephen Colbert show that his dad came up with this story that Peter Sarsgaard used to be a Skarsgård, and then he got banished because he did something horrible, and so he got kicked out, and he's now a Sarsgaard. It was a really funny clip. Yes,
but there's that episode too of him on SNL where he's invited to a club, and he walks in, and he finds out that it's a club full of pirates that just want him to like be the leader because he's like a Sarsgaard.
Yes. Okay. You want to talk about something that pisses me off about this movie?
Yeah.
So they established that Julie and her fiancé were looking for an apartment, but they weren't going to be together until after they were married, because Julie wanted to wait.
Yeah, because Julie, you can actually see, like, she ends up praying later on. She has a cross for a necklace. She is a religious leader.
Okay. Boils and ghouls and variations thereupon. Various entities who happened upon this podcast. What they've established is that Julie is a virgin-ish. Close enough. It's like the shoot to the train equivalent of she's a virtuous woman, right? There's some like a serious BS here, and it makes me mad because first of all, being a virgin is not a huge deal.
Right.
Like I thought it was a huge deal as a kid. And now that I'm an old person, it's a moniker we slap onto children that decides whether or not you're a good person. And it says, if you deny yourself this basic human pleasure, then you are righteous and good and pure and white and light and golden. And it's like, no. What's best about humanity is not whether or not someone has put their genitalia near or on your genitalia. And if she's a virtuous character, it doesn't matter if she's virtuous or not. She's a human being who is being predated on and possibly killed by another human being. And guess what? You know who's in the wrong? The killer.
Correct.
And regardless of her value as a person, good or bad, she's a person who's going to be killed. It doesn't matter.
Right. And for me, like, I'm going to kind of talk about it when we get later to the scene, because she kind of has her own little, like, character arc that they tried to give her, which is interesting because I wouldn't say that anybody else really has a character. Would you say that Catherine has a character arc outside of, you know, having this specific belief tested and then she comes out on top?
Well, yeah, but, no, yeah. She's solid who she is the whole way through, the same way that Vince's character is solidly who he is the whole way through.
Right, and I don't want to say that characters have to have character arcs, because that is kind of a staple of, like, Western, you know, storytelling, is like, oh, yeah, it was specifically, like, over the last 100 years in Hollywood movies.
Oh, like the hero's journey bullshit?
Right.
You don't need that.
Right.
Yeah.
But it definitely makes me feel like, you know, even though, like, these characters don't have that, there's nothing else outside of the fact that they're just people and there's a bunch of stuff happening to them. And then, like, they're reacting, but I wouldn't say that they're ever really responding.
Nobody seems to change very much in the whole of this film, except for maybe, I guess it really could change a little bit. Our perspective of her, our perception of her changes. The biggest arc happens for Carl.
Yeah, definitely.
But okay, so freaking Vince starts to explain to her mom what's going to happen to her. And I don't know what exactly FBI protocol is, but I don't think there's a point where they sit down and are like, Mrs. Julie's mom, here are the things that the serial killer that we think has your daughter is going to do to her. And then starts to explain in great detail the gross, terrible things that are about to happen to her daughter. First, they're going to lock her in her room. And then they're going to feed her a little bit. But then also they're going to kill her a lot of it.
Right.
And here's the way that's going to... No!
I wouldn't. That does not make sense. But the important thing in this scene is that Vince Vaughn, which I think his last name is Novak... Novak is his character's name.
Yes.
And so he ends up, they end up after the interview, they go into, they go out of the house. And that's when someone gets a phone call and they're like, oh, we found the guy.
Generic FBI guy ends up on his phone a lot. And it seems to be like the, hey, we just found out this from doing actual paperwork, like actual police work, actual FBI investigation-y stuff. And he's always on his phone and then he turns around and he's like, ah, yes, dog hair. Ah, yes, we found the... Yeah, it's crazy.
Right. And so it goes into this whole moment where they found out where he lives.
Yes.
And they're going to go ahead and, you know, execute SWAT team force 5. Yeah,
the efficiency of this scene is fantastic. And I like that because it's very much like you see SWAT team moving. Mm-hmm. SWAT team goes here. There's the guy who's like, we're doing this. Vince's like, do you have eyes on him? There's movement in the kitchen, but we don't know what's going on. And then it's done. And we don't have to put a lot of thought on it, but it looks like it needed so much coordination.
Right. And so essentially the SWAT team going into the house is preluded to Carl taking a bath. And then he gets one of his headaches and he can't get any aspirin. And
not that we know that would help.
Right. And so he goes running through his house. And then we see right before the SWAT team go through the house. Mm-hmm. He just falls flat on the floor.
Well, we don't see him fall. What we see is like the guy's like, I got the dog as they're swarming the house.
Right.
And then they all converge in the kitchen. And that's where they find him face down with his ring still in his back.
Right.
And I call the scene Coma Town. He's in Coma Town.
Who are you going to call? Sorry.
Just see you in Coma Town. You can't call anybody. You can't get a phone in Coma Town.
When Starger sings in the bathtub and later while torturing Novak, he's singing a song that Leland Palmer is singing in a scene in Twin Peaks where he has sort of a mental break. That's our second Twin Peaks reference.
That's fantastic.
And so at the end of the SWAT excursion, mm-hmm. They find him lying flat on the floor mm-hmm. in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so it cuts to they're in a doctor's office and the doctor's explaining, yep, guy's in a coma. And this is where we find out that he had a very specific type of schizophrenia that I believe was made up for the movie.
Yeah. OK, so they show his downstairs, not his downstairs.
Oh, his basement.
Yeah. They thoughtfully cover up his downstairs when they're looking at his naked form on the ground because he just got out of the bath, right? But they show this taxidermy and his weird doll. And is this the scene where they push on where they friggin' turn on the TV and watch the lady drowning? And then I think it must cut to the lady who is currently being tortured because this mm-hmm. is where my notes say that Jen says, Alexa, drown this girl.
Well, I think when they're in the basement, there's also like the video mm-hmm. that goes off. Is that what you're referring
to?
Yeah,
yeah, okay. Yeah. But also that we know that this is all going to happen whether or not they find her. Like no one's pulling the switch. She's right. It's just automatic. She's going to die.
Right.
So then we have the doctor saying, well, it's called Whelan's infraction.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. I think they mean infarction. Because according to what I read on IMDb and also the fact that I'm a bit of a biology nerd, infraction means like a fracture, like a broken bone. Infarction means a damage in membrane. So if he had a bone broken in his skull, that would be different than an infarction, which would be something that could swell and eventually break or any number of different things that would have actually connected to something like schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that all doesn't really matter much because Whelan's infraction does not exist. It was made up for this film. But we do learn because of Vince Vaughn's exposition that we now have We probably have another hour left of this film. We have a 40-hour time limit about.
Yeah, and they need to contact someone who can go ahead and get into a comatose person's brain. And the doctor's like, well, I don't know.
Oh. He happens to know about this super obscure billionaire-funded nightmare research program.
Right. Because, you know, word gets around in the medical community.
Cue helicopter number one.
Right.
But also, here's the thing. We've been given a 40-hour limit. I would have appreciated them giving us like some kind of time marker, right? Like 40 hours is like 3 days, 2 days?
2 days. It's it would be less than 2 days.
Okay. I would have liked to have known. Have they slept? Have they done stuff? Like, I know what 48 hours is. It's 2 days.
Yeah.
But like, I would like to have known what the timeline was more like because it feels very jumpy.
Okay, so here's just an inference from it. Uh-huh. I like to think that she probably got taken at hour zero.
That's 7:30 yesterday evening.
Right. So let's say that she had she was knocked out.
Uh-huh.
Then chances are she probably woke up. So they're probably like, this could be like, I would think after, police get called and they get sent to the house, fiance's probably over there because they're waiting for, information. This could very easily be like either morning to early afternoon. So maybe like about no later than 12.
That's the thing, Lydia. The timeline is out the window. Mm-hmm. We literally don't care.
Right.
Because although we've been given the pressure of a 40-hour time limit, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
We don't know if it stopped the second he got her down there and, like, started pressing play because they only get, like, 40 hours of video. We don't know if it absolutely ends when they die on camera because that dude didn't come back until that chick was still twitching.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you can twitch quite a while after death, but, like, how much longer after death?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Right.
Probably not that long, I would assume. Right. It doesn't matter,
right.
But it's a pressure we are given by the director. What makes me super mad about the Whelan's doctor guy is that the assumption is that it compounds the feeling that a doctor would withhold information. And Vince is like, come on, you got to know something. And he's like, well, I guess I do know about this dream doctor. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, don't compound people's belief that doctors are withholding information. They generally are not.
Right. Well, it kind of like the way that the guy plays it, it's more like a, oh, yeah, there was this like there is this thing that's going on that I might know something about, or I might have people that I know about. Mm. So it doesn't feel like, I mean, to me anyways, it doesn't feel like it's compounding, like the doctor's willfully not bringing it up. Mm-hmm. It's more like, oh yeah, there is this one thing that is kind of going on, because you're like trying to problem solve. And sometimes with problem solving, it's like, what paths could we take? Oh, there is this experimental thing that maybe might work.
Yeah, but it makes the doctor seem a little more wishy-washy than the straightforward guns blazing Vince thing. That makes me like feel like, don't undermine medical people.
I could see that.
Carl and the boy have the same thing too, that you were saying, that
the Wayland's
infarcture. Yeah.
The Wayland's
infraction.
Infarction?
Mm-hmm. No, infarction would be the correct term.
Okay.
Infraction is what they say.
Yeah. They have the same thing.
No, I didn't know that. Oh, which you... Mm-hmm.
Which makes it even more coincidental.
How does
mind.
That thing that only happens to mm-hmm. one in 1 billion people right. happens to these two people with a parent who has billions?
As they're bringing Carl into the facility, there's like this moment where everything's in slow-mo. And I'm like, not slow-mo, guys. You're on a timer.
Okay, so we cut to all of the team, who I refer to in my notes as the dream team.
That's a good one.
Thanks. They're like, they cut to a generic white guy doctor, and he's like, I think it's possible. It could be possible. And then they cut to Dr. Miriam, whom I love. She's a fantastic character. Mm-hmm. She's like, I will defer to whatever Catherine says. Mm-hmm. Whatever she says, I'm with her behind her 100%. And I was like, oh, did you just seek consent mm-hmm. before doing a thing that's super dangerous?
Right.
Yeah. Please and thank you. She's the best. And then Catherine's like, I don't know. Would he give this information on if mm-hmm. he was conscious? And Vince is like, he gives indicators that he wants to be caught. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's what he says. And she's like, I don't even know if he's going to be there in there anymore. Mm-hmm. And what it ends up to being is like this. It's basically this okay moment where it's like, should we do this? I don't think we should do this. But I really think it's our only choice. Should we do this? Okay.
Right. It's they show her the video of in the basement. Oh, and like going back to the basement, that's where Carl's whole setup with the bleach baths and the completion machine. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to note something that kind of made me angry. The table that he uses, this whole thing has a specific symbol on it and it has a name on it. And my thought was, you know, in the year of our Lord 2000, wouldn't you at least like, I mean, it seems like a very specific kind of brand, and it seems like there's like a name on there.
You think it's a solid brand, Lydia?
Wouldn't you like maybe go checking through the yellow book?
Is it a solid brand, Lydia? A dependable brand? Is it as good as DeWalt?
I mean, obviously it's as good as DeWalt because it doesn't seem to fall apart.
I got opinions about that.
So, sorry, don't mean to kind of go back in there, but it's important. So later on.
Also, when we're in the conference room, Vince Vaughn is like, is it possible? And then like leans in and looks harder and he's like, is it possible? And I'm like, probability is never zero.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very, very improbable.
Right.
So you're asking her to risk her life. Is it possible? Yeah. And wild orangutans could fall out of my butthole and start a civilization that creates the movie that is Fantastic Planet. And we watch it stoned off her ass. Is that going to happen, Vince? Probably not. But the odds aren't zero. Is it possible?
Possibility and probability are two wildly different things.
Right. Hey, why are there three suits on that wall?
Oh, it's because we tried to do two therapists and it didn't ultimately work.
Edward hated it. He'd only talk to Catherine. She has a gift.
Right. And it's kind of like, you know, it plays up this whole like she's special because she has like something inherently inside of her because, yeah.
And then she proves it because Dr. Miriam's like, what happened here? We had to remove 14 rings from this guy's back. And then Catherine leans her head out the window and she's just like at the side of this changing area. And she's like, oh, he used to suspend himself. You should have left him like he was. He liked the feeling of weightlessness. They like that. It's like floating in water.
Right. Is there some exposition about his past?
Well, yes. That this, I think Dr. I only call him Dr. Wayland's because he's there for that one scene. But he talked about there being a traumatic event probably involving water. And the fact that she brings it up validates the fact that she's very intuitive and can totally like get this guy on a level that nobody else can because she just gets it, you know? And leaving him in his natural state.
Right. And so we do see the transition process of her being in this world and then going into the dream world. And I really like the transitions in this movie.
Yeah. Yes. It's weird that they like transition to her being in the dream world on this string of praise about how great she is, about being an amazing blah, blah, blah.
Social worker. And I mean, social workers have a really hard job. We are not here to knock them, but it's...
They were saying psychologists and people with advanced degrees weren't able to do the job she could do. And it felt very much like in every... Joe Schmo Goes to Space movie, like when they're like, this guy from NASA can't do it, we better get the mechanic from down the street who's like, I only work on hogs, but yeah, I'll get you on that asteroid. And it's like,
yeah, it's a very Armageddon feel to it.
It's like,
yeah.
All right.
So I really like my note about the visuals were that they were just as pretty as J-Lo's hair, because her hair's like all like short and it's curly, and like every lock of curl is like its own like character.
Yeah. It's its own story.
Yeah.
I labeled this scene cool flippy bits.
Yeah. So she wakes up. She has this like shroud on her face, and you see like drops of blood falling down.
Jesus's face is on that shroud as well.
Right. There's a drop of blood that gets in the eye on the shroud.
And then we see a drop of blood fall onto animal number 6.
Ladybug.
It's a ladybug.
Beetle, 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 beetle.
A drop of bloody water hits this leaf that this bug is crawling on, and it just goes, wee. Do you know that TikTok that's like, oh my God, wee. Oh my God, wee. It happens to a ladybug like 2 or 3 times. But also we get animal number 7.
Right. It's right after she after the ladybug, she goes and she sees Carl running and there's that gap.
She sees a black wolf.
Oh,
that's right.
And
yes.
Then she sees a cricket, which is animals 6, 7, and 8. And I know I'm counting bugs, but you guys can scream at your radios on your own. If it has a face and it is not a human, I counted it nearly always as an animal, as long as it wasn't one of those weird dolls. I'm not counting the dolls. Right?
Those are inanimate objects.
Thank
it's
you. Okay, so it's a living creature with a face. So we got 6, ladybugs, 7, black wolf, 8, crickets. And then we kind of loop into a traumatic baptism that we don't address really, but we see it in this really...
That's like, part of the transition.
Yeah.
Like it goes through. So you see like the circuitry on these like silver cloths that go over their faces.
Uh-huh.
And as you're going through the circuitry, you see these dolls, which I always take as like in her mind, she's like remembering the dolls that he does. And that's like part of it.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes through the water and you get these like, you know, like water lilies or the water foliage.
There's a lot of plants in that water. It's real murky and weird. Like, why would you pick to do your baptisms there?
Right.
But you got like the guy baptizing the kids. I didn't recognize which specific guy was the dad, but either the people were looking down at the water so you couldn't see their face, or they were looking up with such rapture that it was like uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And then they would do these big swoopy motions from looking up towards the camera to going down into the water and sweeping their arms through. And as one person does that, then we kind of go past their hands as they're bent over to the feet, and the feet become flat on this panel, that this panel becomes the floor. And then we follow this reflection up, and it turns to the left, and it becomes this catacomb sewer area.
And that's where we have shroud, blood, animals 6, 7, and 8.
And so she starts to walk, and that's where we get, and I can't say this name, but it's called the Schacht Stairs. It's by the artist, I think the name of the piece is Schacht. But the stairs are these really desolate steps that stretch on for, it almost looks like the stairs in Spirited Away. You know how they're on the side of the building and she's terrified to go down them?
Yeah.
Okay, but imagine that, not cute, not Ghibli, but on these desolate grayscale stairs.
It's painted by H.R. Geiger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, it's S-C-H-A-C-H-T. So in Swiss, that might be like Schacht or Schacht. Isn't this the greatest visual medium of all time podcast?
They're desolate stairs that seem to stretch on forever.
If we haven't already said this in this podcast, applauders, I'm sorry, but this is a very visual movie and we will not be able to go through everything. You really should just watch the movie if you want to really get it, because there's like other references to paintings, right, in the later on.
Yes, there are several other paintings, mm-hmm. painting references.
So we see, okay, the reason she finds the stairs is because she sees a little boy run away and she follows him, right?
Right.
And he runs up these stairs and she's like, huh? And then she kind of looks left, right. She doesn't know how to get up those stairs. And then dream transition, she's on the other side of this big chasm between her and the boy, walking into the door that he walked into. And it's weird. It's a very clinical room with like fluorescency lights. And there's a horse in the middle of the room. And she's like, oh. And in the way that you work with any child, it's like, oh, what is here that I can bond with this person about?
And this boy is specifically petting the horse.
And so she walks over and she starts petting the horse. And he like looks under the horse's neck at her. And I think that doesn't look very safe. And she's like, oh, hello. And he like dodges a little bit. And she's like, oh, I know another little boy with a horse. His name is Edward, the boy, not the horse. And that's like one of two jokes in the entirety of this film. The kid throws himself against the wall. And he's like, and she's like, is your name Carl? And he's like, And then she's like, she starts petting the horse and she's like, what a nice. And then this clock starts ticking and it starts going really fast. And it's like, dun, 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 dun. And it looks like a 60-second clock, but it's probably less than 15 seconds. And as the needle enters the red five last portions of this clock, the kid runs forward. He had glanced up at the ceiling at these weird, spiky, shardy, beveled, I would say beveled pointy bits. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I don't know what that is. And she keeps petting the horse. And he's like, oh no. As the needle starts hitting the red buttons, he pushes her out of the way. She falls back. Did you notice? She falls back. And then he falls back against the wall. And then you see her do like a full body roll. Oh, she does. I'm assuming that's her bodyguard. Bodyguard?
Stunt double.
Thank you. Stunt double does a full body roll backwards away from it. And she's like, ah. And then it goes. Wah. And then this horse, this living, breathing, beautiful brown horse, which is, by the way, animal number 9.
Mm-hmm.
It goes, these shards of glass goes whoom, down on the floor and then separate, segmenting this horse into several places, which turns into a Sean fact.
Yes, it does. This scene in which the horse is cut into segments suspended in glass cases, inspired by the work of British artist Damien Hirst.
Oh, hey, guess what? I wrote down what I thought the name was an hour after I wrote down what the name was in my brain.
Yeah.
I call it Comfort That Lies in the Something Sliced. I can't read my own handwriting.
The installation that Sean references is called Some Comfort Gained from the Acceptance of the Inherent Lies in Everything.
Which I, having looked at the pictures from the whole of the exhibit, or whatever first comes up when you go online, is that you look at an animal and you think of it as that one solid thing that is that thing. But when you slice it in half or you slice it in multiple layers, you find out that there's so much more to that creature. I mean, it could be some super complicated version of Ogre's Got Layers. It feels a bit like that.
Yeah.
Like she's coming in and she's like, oh, this sweet boy. And he's like, no, no, I'm not just this sweet boy. You don't know what the guts look like. But I will say that the twitchy horse in those little bits where the lungs are flaring and it's so cool looking.
Yeah. The horse is still alive, even though it's been segmented.
Well, here's the thing. It's not alive, Jen. It's just that there are stages of death that we don't acknowledge.
Okay.
Why that girl twitched and scared the pee out of that guy, the pee out of Carl earlier.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can fully not be present anymore. There's stages of death. It's very Princess Bride. There's dead, there's kind of dead and all dead, you know?
Right.
This horse is mostly dead. It's just that its bits and pieces haven't figured it out yet, so they're like squidging against the glass.
Right.
It's very gross and very cool.
Hey, this is your audio engineer and no longer Freddy Krueger's agent after not being able to land him this film, Jen. I only have a small message for you this week before we return next Tuesday for part 3 of our review of 2000's The Cell. And that message is, thank you. We know you have tons of choices for film podcasts, and it means so much that you continue to listen to us rant about some of our fan favorite and peculiar films. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.